From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The August recess is finally over. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After a month of angry town halls all over the country, Congress returns to Washington with its lowest public opinion ratings in 24 years. Tomorrow night, President Obama will address a joint session on health care reform, promising that he's all fired up and ready to go. But there's a cold wind blowing from the Republicans and from Blue Dog and progressive Democrats. Next up, global warming and finance reform. What are the prospects for an ambitious agenda in an environment of political hostility? On Reporter's Notebook later on, can Afghanistan's election results be believed? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Congress is back after the August recess, faced with the same problems it failed to address in July. We'll hear about health care, global warming, finance reform, and partisan Republicans and divided Democrats. On Reporter's Notebook, President Hamid Karzai has enough votes, but Afghanistan's Electoral Complaints Commission has ordered a partial recount of last month's election. First, this news update. The president's plan for an inspirational back-to-school message was initially attacked by some conservatives as a recipe for socialist indoctrination. Today's speech at Wakefield High School in Arlington, Virginia, contained passages like this.
And even when you're struggling, even when you're discouraged, and you feel like other people have given up on you, don't ever give up on yourself. Because when you give up on yourself, you give up on your country. The story of America isn't about people who quit when things got tough. It's about people who kept going, who tried harder, who loved their country too much to do anything less than their best.
Tom Hamburger reports from Washington for the Los Angeles Times. And Tom, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yesterday, the White House issued a transcript of the speech. Have most of the people who complained about it initially backed off now?
Well, it's hard to know what group we're talking about, but some of the most prominent complainants have backed off. There is a Republican Party official in Florida, Greer, who originally suggested that Obama was going to use this as an opportunity to spew his socialist ideology, and he's since said it's a good speech. There are still some protesters, and even this morning, as the president made his way to Wakefield High School, there was a little gaggle of protesters' parents, one waving a sign that said, stay away from our kids. But I would say that anyone who was protesting earlier in sort of the mainstream or of Republican politics or even conservative ideology has, for the most part, read the speech and concluded there is nothing to complain about.
Originally, there was a plan for some kind of lesson plan to go along with this. Have they withdrawn that?
Yeah, that's what sort of got things. That was the catalyst that got what has struck me, Warren, as kind of a silly story rolling. The Education Department, in its original releases to school, suggested a lesson plan that would have children, after listening to the speech, write a letter or an essay titled "How I Can Help the President." And that was roundly criticized. The White House has since rewritten those instructions to teachers, suggested lesson plans, but that was, you're right, probably the controversial element in all of this that got this late summer controversy boiling.
Other presidents have delivered similar speeches, including George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. Did they have the same kind of flap?
Well, there were some flaps, actually. There was a bit of a flap around both of those presidential speeches. When George W. Bush spoke in, he was criticized by then House Democratic Leader Dick Gephardt for using Department of Education funds to pursue his own political agenda. So it had a bit, there are some partisan echoes here. Ronald Reagan actually gave a much more sort of partisan and ideological speech when he spoke to high school students, talking about smaller government and cutting taxes and that sort of thing. Barack Obama went nowhere near that sort of kind of ideological or partisan issue in his talk today.
In that case, were there congressional investigations afterward? Were there hearings about it?
You know, I understand that that Gebhardt, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, called the Education Department to account for the spending of the funds that went into the preparation of the broadcast and lesson plans and that sort of thing.
Well, here we are talking about this, even though nobody at the moment of any prominence seems to think there was a political message here or anything other than an inspirational one to kids to work hard and take seriously their education. Has the mainstream media, have all of us exaggerated this?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, there's a phenomenon. In fact, the president referred to it, this sort of late August phenomenon. This is early September, of course, but there's not a lot going on. People have been on vacation, and a controversy emerges with some firebrands using pretty hot rhetoric, suggesting the president is using this moment to spew his socialist ideology, and it catches fire. Remember, it happened when Congress was out of town, when there was a search for news stories, and I think that even some of us on the sort of traditional and respectable press went a little tabloid in our evaluation of the seriousness of it.
Well, and we're about to spend the rest of our program talking about what's going on in Washington and the atmosphere there, particularly over health reform, the economy, and some of these other issues. So no doubt that general environment contributed to this.
Absolutely, Warren. I think that's another you asked about there's a press component here in which the norms of the press play up something that's kind of a silly or a controversy that doesn't have great significance. But what it does point to, if you wanted to look at the substance, I think, is the continued polarization that exists. And, of course, that was one of the things Barack Obama wanted most to do with his election, was sort of change the nature of the polarized and partisan conversation. And at least if today and the weekend discussion was any indication, that's not happening.
And it's worth pointing out that some schools around the country didn't carry the speech, and others allowed kids to leave if their parents wanted them to. Tom Hamburger, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to talk to you.
Staff writer for the Los Angeles Times in Washington. In a moment, the August recess finally over on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Legislative proposals for health care, global warming, financial regulations, all of those things present major political and legislative challenges. But Capitol Hill may seem like a refuge to some members of the House and the Senate. Congress returns to Washington with its lowest public approval ratings in 24 years. That's according to the Pew Research Center for the Public and the Press, People and the Press. Andy Cohut is president. And Andy, good to have you back on our program.
Happy to be with you, Warren.
How bad is it?
Pretty bad. We had 37% saying that a favorable view of Congress, and we've been asking this question since 1985, and that's about as low as it got. And even as recently as April, we had 50% saying they had a favorable view of Congress. The public thinks that Congress and the president are back at it. 24% say they're working together. 63% say they're not working together. Back in February, the public was at least evenly divided on a question that had for a decade now found people thinking that the Congress and the president weren't getting along. So the public sees conflict. It feels conflicted itself about the major issues of the day. The president's approval rating has dropped from 62% mark at the first 100 days to 51%. And as I just said, the favorable rating of the Congress is at a 25-year low.
When you say that many people think that the Congress and the president are not working together, that would seem surprising given the fact that they're both of the same party.
Well, when we ask, well, who's to blame for this, 29% say the Republican leaders, 17% say Barack Obama, and 9% say both. So the Democrats, in that respect, are getting off the hook a little bit, but that's about the only thing they're getting off the hook on, because we find the ratings for the Democratic Party dropping from 60 to 50% in a few months, and our early congressional horse race questions indicate that we might have a very close popular vote next year as opposed to a clear Democratic majority as we've had in the last in the last two national congressional elections.
There's been practically nonstop coverage of the health care reform issue and the town hall meetings and all of that. But does that seem to be the major thing behind this reduction in or decline in support, or is it more complex?
Well, I think that's a large part of it, because the Congress is now associated with a issue that the public says is important to them. It affects them personally. 78% of the poll we're releasing today say that. And we have a majority, plurality of people saying they don't like the proposals that the Congress has come up with. We find a significant number saying they do, but still the opponents outnumber the supporters. And but it's not only that. There's also the economy. The economy is maybe doing better with respect to the stock market, or reports of lower rates of increased unemployment than expected. But you know, that kind of news doesn't assuage the concerns of people who see the unemployment rate itself approaching 10%. And the public gets impatient. They want things to get better. The state of the nation is not judged very well. And so they have a less favorable view of Congress and the party that leads it, and a less favorable view of the president, even though in personal terms, the president still gets pretty good favorable ratings, and people have confidence that in the long run he's going to figure these things out still.
How does he compare to his most recent predecessors, George Bush and Bill Clinton, in terms of favorability at this point in his term?
Well, with respect to his approval scores, he's about where President Bush was in 2001, just before the 9/11 attacks. And he's actually in much better shape than President Clinton was. Obama's approval rating in our poll was 51-52%. Clinton had a 39 back in 93.
Wow.
But, of course, keep in mind that Clinton was not elected by a majority of the vote in 92. Whereas Obama did get a 53% majority. In many respects, Obama's levels of support are now comparable to where they were on Election Day, which he won. But prior to this, at the beginning of the year, we saw very high levels of enthusiasm from him, from all kinds of quarters, especially from independents and even some Republicans. But a lot of that has fallen away.
Should point out that George Bush in 2000, a lot of people thought he didn't win at all.
Well, there's that.
What about the independents? They're very important, obviously, now more important probably than Democrats and Republicans to what happens next in terms of who controls the Congress.
Absolutely crucial. And what we see, I'll just read you a few numbers, is the decline in the congressional favorable rating was mostly among independents. If between April and in August, it fell from 47% among independents to 31%. That's a 16-point drop. It hardly moved among Republicans, 29 to 25, and among Democrats, it's still reasonably positive, 66 to 55. A decline, but still majority positive. So independents are crucial. They helped get, more than anything else, they got Obama elected. And they are the ones who have been most central to the negative balance of opinion about health care reform. Many independents were very worried about growing government and too much government control, and what government might mean to their own health care. Now, Republicans are even more concerned, but that's to be expected, and Democrats more supportive. But so the independent opinion and the independent vote, so to speak, is really important.
So given the kind of research that you have done, how important is the speech by the president tomorrow to a joint session of Congress on health care at this point?
Well, no one speech can change things dramatically, but he can really get the conversation going in a way that's helpful to his cause and to the cause of the Democrats. One of the things that we find, and we're putting out a poll today, is despite the fact that most people say that this is a very important issue to them generally and personally, 75%, we still have people, 66-67% of the people saying, I don't understand this issue. I don't know what's being proposed. So if the president can make clear what's on the table, he can do himself some good.
Andrew Cohut, president of the Pew Research Center on the People and the Press. Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for Time magazine. She's done a lot of work on health care reform and has interviewed the president about it. Karen, good to have you back on our program.
It's good to be here.
How does the president feel, or what did he say, at least, before the August recess when you spoke to him about the prospects for his health care reform, his strategy, and how people, he thinks, how the public, he feels, is moving on it?
Well, mind you, this was before all the chaos of these town hall meetings and everything like that. But the president, even then, felt like public opinion was moving away from him. Interestingly enough, during the interview, he acknowledged something that politicians rarely do, which is that he was reading the polling. And, you know, he understood. He said, coming on top of everything else that this government, this administration has done this year, that people were feeling a little bit overwhelmed by the prospect of embarking on something this big. He just said he didn't this didn't necessarily change his feeling that we needed to do this, but he really thought that he personally had to do a better job of explaining it.
What do you think, based on your conversation with him, what you've heard since, is the strategy for tomorrow night? Will he, as so many have said that he has to do, get more specific?
Well, certainly the White House is suggesting they will. I think something that is happening as we speak is even more important, and that is that after months of trying to come up with some kind of bipartisan agreement with some members of the Senate Finance Committee, the Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus is putting out his own proposal today, and he's essentially at a meeting with his negotiating group going to put down the law to some of the Republicans, and he's going to say, look, you guys either put a counterproposal on the table or I am moving ahead. Now, this is important because it was really the Finance Committee that has been holding up action in the Congress. There are four other committees that have already acted. So this is the very important backdrop that the president will be speaking against tomorrow night.
So what is the significance of the backdrop? What specifically is Max Baucus talking about doing, and how do Republicans seem to feel about it?
Well, I doubt that he is going to get any significant Republican support for this plan beyond Olympia Snow of Maine, possibly Susan Collins of Maine. But what this raises is the possibility that they could actually get those 60 votes that they need to get in the Senate to get past a filibuster and just to get this process moving. You know, as much as anything, I think to the president's speech tomorrow night is designed to be a circuit breaker to kind of freeze this August, what happened in August in place so that Congress can sort of get back into motion and get moving towards something this fall.
Now, when you say Baucus has a plan, does it or does it not include the so-called public option?
It does not. It includes what is being called a co-op. It's a concept that is familiar to people in rural America. Rather than a government-run option, it would be a private sort of member-owned option. But I think that what is likely to happen between now and the time this thing gets to the Senate floor is we are likely to see this proposal of Senator Snowe's, which is for a public option, but only if the insurance industry fails to kind of step up to the plate and establish the kind of competition that is really needed, and which, by the way, is lacking in most states at this point.
So that's the so-called trigger.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, you know, there's all kinds of versions of that being talked about, the hair trigger. but I do think that this Olympia Snow proposal, people are speaking about it very hopefully, and this may be the road to 60 votes.
Would this also include either one of them, Max Baucus or Olympia Snow, the question of portability, the elimination of the pre-existing condition, and the coverage of so many that are now uninsured?
That is what they call the insurance market reforms, basically getting rid of these situations where you can be denied coverage based on the fact that you've been sick in the past. Those things are included in every bill that would prevent insurance companies from doing that. One very big question, however, is how far we're going to get down the road to universal coverage. And this here, it's really a question of money, because if you're going to require people to go out and buy health insurance, people who don't already get it from their employers, in a lot of cases, the government is going to have to give them some financial help to help them do that. And that's one of the things that runs up the price tag on this bill. So it's a real competition between trying to cover as many people as you can and trying to keep the price tag of the bill as low as you can.
Trying to keep it below $1 trillion in 10 years.
That's right. And the Baucus bill, and I'm still reading it, is under $900 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but it's less than we've been talking about in these other measures.
Let me go back to Andy Kohut with the Pew Research Center. You said earlier that 66 to 67% of the people say they don't understand what's being talked about. Are these concepts we've just been discussing with Karen Tumulty, the portability, the pre-existing condition, the universal coverage, are those things that the people do understand?
Well, some of them for sure, but there's a lot of code in the coverage of this. I mean, I'm sure that if you ask the average person, what do you think about the public option? After a while, if you began to describe it, they say, "Oh yeah, I've heard about that." But there are a lot of aspects and elements of this that are pretty confusing to people. And keep in mind, this is an issue that comes very close to home. Most of the policy debates that people hear about in Washington, it's two or three times removed from their lives. This is not. And so when you talk about taxing people's benefits or taxing the benefits of rich people as a way of paying for this, and any one of the number of things that have been raised here as possibilities, the question's been, well, what does rich person mean? How will this affect my choices? How will my preferences and restrictions on my coverage, especially among older people? Every one of the polls that I've seen about this about reform shows older people with the greatest concerns. The irony is concern about government being too involved in health care, but older people, of course, being on a government, and most of them being on a government health care program, Medicare.
And Karen Tumulty, one further question to you. I know you both needed to leave us at the half hour, but what about what's called reconciliation? If they can't get the 60 votes, they don't get Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins or some other Republicans. What's reconciliation? What's that mean?
Reconciliation is the biggest misnomer I can think of. It's a name for a parliamentary procedure in the Senate where you don't have to get 60 votes to get that you need to block a filibuster.
It's the opposite of reconciliation.
Right, exactly.
We're going to jam it down your throat, isn't it?
Exactly. You can do this on 51 votes. The problem is that if they do find themselves in a position of having to pass this bill under this reconciliation procedure, they're going to have to pass a much, much smaller bill probably because it's got to pay for itself in 5 years. And they're also likely to see it ripped apart on the Senate floor because it would be subject to all kinds of parliamentary challenges that a normal bill really isn't.
Okay. We're going to continue this conversation with some other guests to talk further about what's likely to happen in Congress. Also discuss bringing up issues like global warming and finance reform as well, other things important to the president. In the meantime, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Andy Kohut, president of the Pew Research Center, many thanks to both of you for being with us. And on Reporter's Notebook, an official finding of widespread fraud in Afghanistan's presidential election. We'll talk about that later. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, Manali, back with To the Point, talking to you again about the return of Congress and the Senate to Capitol Hill after the tumultuous August recess, much more tumultuous than most recesses are. And, of course, we can't help but talk about health care reform. We'll try to get to other issues as well. Thomas Mann is Senior Fellow of Government Studies at the Brookings Institution, wrote the book The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Thomas Mann, good to have you on our program.
Warren, happy to be with you.
Tell me, there, in addition to the Republican opposition, perhaps broken only by Olympia Snowe and or Susan Collins, perhaps not at all, there's also Democratic problems with this. Some of the progressives saying if there's no public option, they're going to kill this bill. Others, the Blue Dogs, so-called, saying if there is a public option, they're not going to go near it. Set that up, and are we seeing the broken branch at work?
Actually not. In this case, it's perfectly understandable. The progressives represent, for the most part, urban districts, overwhelmingly Democratic, strong support for Barack Obama. The moderates and conservatives disproportionately represent districts and states that that was carried rather easily by John McCain, and where Republicans have won in the past, they tend to be more in the South. They tend to be in rural areas. So it's natural that when you're talking about reforming 17-18% of the economy in a way that affects virtually every interest and individual in society, that you're going to get some differences. But I have to tell you, I've never seen a more unified Democratic Party in my lifetime. So it's all a relative thing. I was struck by the number of Democrats who came back from the August recess who felt the excesses of the sort of anger and hate mongering over death panels and the like weren't really representative of their people, and frankly many of them have come to the conclusion that if we the Democratic Party is going to survive and maintain their majority status and get things done, they're going to have to pass some health reform bill this year. So I think most Democrats accept the view that a failure, no bill, the status quo is not acceptable.
I think it was Will Rogers that said, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat."
Absolutely.
And you're now saying they're more unified than ever before after all that we've seen.
Certainly since the early part of the 20th century, they're more unified. Look how they stuck together for the most part on the stimulus bill, which had not a single Republican vote in the House. There have been about a dozen major pieces of legislation that have passed. Of course, they're going to fight this out on committee and on the floor. A number from conservative districts will be given the green light to vote against the bill. You know, all you need is a simple majority in the House. The Senate's more complicated, and there the pressure will be on to at least vote cloture and then vote your district on the passage of the substantive bill itself. So I actually think that all of this chatter about the sky is falling, the low ratings of Congress, Obama's approval ratings failing, the dissent in the Democratic Party overlooks one huge reality, which is we are closer today to major health reform than we have ever been in this country, and the odds are that something significant will pass this calendar year.
Thomas Mann again at the Brookings Institution. Jennifer Duffy is senior editor and political analyst for the Cook Political Report. Jennifer Duffy, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
Are you as optimistic, if that's the appropriate word, that we're going to have health care reform as Thomas Mann?
I'm not sure I'd use the word optimistic. There will be some sort of health reform bill passed, probably by the end of the year. You know, how big it is, you know, how universal it is really does remain to be seen. I will take a little bit of issue with him about, you know, the Democrats coming back united, at least in the Senate. I actually think the recess cost them Democratic support, especially if a bill does include a public option.
What kind of support from whom?
Well, I think that somebody like Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, who was originally, you know, leaning towards accepting a public option, has now said she won't vote for one. Both senators from North Dakota seem against it now. So the point is that Democrats are going to need more than Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins.
You mean they might lose Democrats in the Senate to, and that obviously is crucial, pardon me,
right,
to getting those 60 votes.
Well, that's right. And right now, frankly, they don't even have 60 votes. They have 59. Although probably by October, that 60th Democrat will be back. But for now, they don't have those votes. But I sort of counted the number of Democratic senators today who have expressed some either outright opposition to or big concerns about the public option. I got to 13.
Okay, and 59, of course, because of the absence of Senator Edward Kennedy.
That's right.
The late Senator Edward Kennedy. Jennifer Duffy with the Cook Political Report. Thomas Mann, back to you. What about that? What about these senators that have pulled away?
Yeah, but wait, what Jennifer's has talked about one feature of the bill, which in my view is not a particularly major feature in substantive terms, the public option. But there is enormous agreement on a new health insurance exchange, of reform to deal with pre-existing conditions and cutting people off because of serious health episodes. There is broad agreement on subsidies to help move people toward universal coverage, on mandates on individuals, and some form of employer contribution, if not in coverage and helping finance those employees. There's broad agreement on aspects of financing it. The public option has taken on this sort of symbolic role, but the signs are all around that it's going to be finessed in the end game. Ben Nelson, over the August recess, you know, who is probably the Democrat least likely to support health reform, said, "Oh, I can live with a public option with a trigger." Well, that was a sign of what's going on. You're getting the same reaction from some House liberals. So I think in the end, Democrats will come to realize the public option is a means to an end and not an end itself. And if there are other ways of achieving it, that will prove acceptable. The object now is to get bills out of the House and Senate so you can go to conference where you'll actually write the bill. So the Senate is going to produce something somewhat more limited, the House more expansive, and then comes the hard calculations of what will pass both bodies. And so I think that's more doable than taking readings from reactions to the public option itself.
Really important to emphasize the procedure in Congress, where each house has to pass a bill. Often they're very different. They then go into a conference committee and try to hash it out and come out with a single bill, and then both houses vote on that. So back to Jennifer Duffy with regard to the trigger, the Olympia Snow idea, which Karen Tumulty seems to think might, in fact, be the thing that provides the great difference. If you eliminate the public option for a moment, as Thomas Mann did, what about all this agreement?
Oh, I think that you can produce a bill that either has no public option in it or very modified public option, like Senator Snow's trigger provision. I was reminded over the weekend that they did the Medicare prescription Part D program with a similar trigger that, by the way, has not been pulled as of yet. And that could generate enough support. But there's got to be some flexibility within the leadership of actually considering all those options.
All right. Let us move away for the moment from health care reform. What, Jennifer Duffy, about the climate change bill and the energy bill, another enormous package?
It is another enormous package. The ball is in the Senate's court at this point. And, the question is, do they have the sort of time and the will to take it up beyond maybe hearings and markup? I think health care is really going to suck all the oxygen out of the room, at least until the Senate passes some sort of bill. And then they can move on to other things like climate change. Unclear about what kind of climate change bill the Senate can produce. There's some opposition to the thrust of the House bill, which is this notion of cap and trade, but they may get it through anyway.
You think so, in the Senate?
Eventually, and I would be very surprised if the Senate were actually able to pass a bill by the end of the year. There's certainly no conference with the House that's completed by the end of the year.
Thomas Mann, what about it? Are we going to get climate change sooner or later?
later. I agree with Jennifer. I think the odds of a bill clearing the House, which would require a supermajority of 60 votes, are slim. The economy's in the worst shape, and has been, what we've gone through really since the Great Depression. So we shouldn't be surprised by low favorability ratings, and we shouldn't be surprised that when you're trying to deal with an issue like energy and the environment and climate change, that there's real resistance. So I think it's probably going to require a recovering economy. I have a feeling this is part of the agenda that will wait for better economic times.
Jennifer Duffy, what about finance reform, particularly finance reform that includes consumer protections after all that we have been through with Wall Street?
Well, I mean, that is certainly a big item on the president's agenda. They would really like to see this, what they call, you know, regulation of the financial services industry to happen. But it's not so much the substance of the bill that is getting in the Senate's way right now. It is instead this game of musical chairs we're about to play among committee chairmen. And in Senator Kennedy's death, he leaves open the chairmanship of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Now, Senator Dodd, who has been sort of filling in his chair there, wants to take that chair permanently. That means he's got to give up his chairmanship of the Banking Committee. The next in line to chair banking is Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota, who has a very different relationship with the financial services community than Senator Dodd does, and will be a very different chairman. He's a much more moderate Democrat. So, you know, I think things are in flux there a little bit for the moment. So that may not move, at least on the Senate side, anytime soon.
Thomas Mann, back to you. Again, your book is The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. What should the Democrats be learning now that they control both the White House and the Congress from the Republicans who controlled both the White House and the Congress, and aside from the Iraq War, and didn't get a lot out of it?
Well, one thing is to remember they are an independent branch of government. They are the first branch of government, and they should not simply bend to the wishes of the president, particularly in the area of foreign policy. Actually, this Democratic Congress has been much tougher on its Democratic president than Republicans were on President Bush. They're asking tough questions, certainly about Afghanistan and Pakistan, about Guantanamo, about intelligence oversight. So I think on that score, they've shown some real improvement. But the other difficult thing is it's clear that the severe ideological polarization between the parties continues unabated. The Republicans have decided they're not interested in legislating with the administration. They're looking to bloody the president's nose to kill health reform, not to amend it. That, of course, then leads to a further War of the Roses, where Speaker Pelosi squeezes down on the process, and we lose the ability of Congress to operate, but in a deliberative fashion. But my own view is, given this polarization, Obama and the Democrats are just going to have to win it on party grounds, the big issue, and hope after that, if prospects look good politically for the Democrats, that more Republicans will be interested in actually engaging in lawmaking with them. And then Democratic leadership needs to move to loosen the reins a bit and allow Congress to breathe on both sides of the aisle.
Jennifer Duffy, back to you. Do you agree that the Republicans decided they were in such terrible shape after the last election that the only thing really they had to do or were able to do was try to stop the president rather than doing anything positive?
Oh, I'm not sure I buy into it 100%. I mean, certainly they are playing, a game here and a chess match. I don't think that they will actually succeed in standing in the way of some kind of health care bill. They will, in fact, probably succeed in standing in the way of something like a public option. But, you know, eventually when Democrats get their 60 seats back, there's going to be very little Republicans can do to stop legislation without the help of some Democrats. And that's really, I think, in the Senate and in the House, you know, the challenge for the party is these moderate Democrats who, aren't willing to vote with the leadership on every single issue.
Have the Republicans been more successful as the party out of power than the Democrats, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but we're about to get an interesting test. The fiscal year ends in 22 days on September 30th, and Congress should have passed 13 appropriations bills to keep the government funded for the next fiscal year. Now, this did not happen once the entire time Bush was in office, and Democrats were very, very hard on Republicans and the Bush White House for not getting this done. Now, here we are on September 8th, and guess what? Congress has yet to pass one of the 13 appropriations bills. The tough part for Democrats is, one, they were so critical of Republicans for doing the very same thing, but two, this is something that the president said he wanted to change. And so something that he didn't change. I'm sure that Republicans are going to give Democrats a raft of grief for this, and it'll be interesting to see how they responded to that.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. Jennifer Duffy, senior editor, political analyst at the Cook Political Report. Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution, writer of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. We'll talk about the back on track part on another program. Thanks to you both. Thanks also to Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine and Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center. Good to have all of you with us. Preliminary results show that President Hamid Karzai received enough votes for re-election, but the Afghanistan Independent Elections Commission has ordered a partial recount due to clear and convincing evidence of fraud. That's their phrase. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Fake polling sites, neatly rounded numbers, and voting stations where turnout was 100%. All of these things are raising questions about the legitimacy of Afghanistan's presidential election. Brian Katulis is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was a member of the Democracy International Election Observation Mission while the election was taking place in Afghanistan. Brian Katulis, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
You said last week that you thought, and everybody thought, there was going to be a certain degree of corruption in this situation. It was the first time that the Afghans themselves had been in charge of the election. Are you surprised at the amount of information that has come out, particularly the New York Times story of Sunday about all of the fake polling places where nobody voted at all, but a lot of votes came in?
Yeah, it's getting to be a little astonishing at this point. I mean, we certainly, the group I was with, saw some of the irregularities, but the size and the number, I think, are growing by the day. And we're not talking about a couple of hanging chads here. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of votes in some instances. It looks like we've got about more than 90% of the vote. Karzai seems to have, in this preliminary result, passed the 50% threshold, but the results are not certified. And we've got about 250,000 votes already thrown out, in part because of some problems with the ballots, and then also because some candidates actually dropped out. Another 200,000 discarded due to fraud. And the election authorities are still trying to deal with thousands of complaints. The serious complaints now number upwards of 700. So it's I think still very early in this process, but it's looking and quite tough to get to the sort of definition of some sort of success as defined by the Obama administration. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who is a lead envoy on this, said in late July that They were looking for an election, quote, whose outcome is accepted as legitimate by the Afghan people and the world, which reflects the will of the desires of those who vote. And I think it's still too early to tell, but all of these problems could represent serious challenges for the legitimacy of the whole election process.
What about the authorities themselves, the Electoral Complaints Commission, the Independent Elections Commission? Weren't they, in fact, appointed by Karzai?
Yeah, the Independent Electoral Commission was appointed by Karzai without any sort of confirmation by the lower house of parliament. The lower house of parliament had asked for that. They didn't get it. The Electoral Complaints Commission is a different sort of body. It's actually a hybrid international and Afghan body. So it I think, presumably has a bit more independence. It has actually ordered an audit of some of the stations. It's looking into some of these extensive allegations. And we still may be looking at another week, if not longer, before we actually get close to certified results, given the long list of concerns and complaints that have been issued to this Electoral Complaints Commission.
Now, the main issue, as you just indicated in your quote from Mr. Holbrooke, is whether the Afghans themselves will accept these results. What are the opponents saying, particularly those who feel that they have forced Mr. Karzai into a runoff? And what are the prospects that they might have to hold a second election just to maintain credibility?
Well, look, the allegations of fraud and complaints about this election began even before the balloting took place. And Abdullah Abdullah, who's the lead challenger, at various points this summer said that he would not recognize a Karzai victory. And in some cases, some of his supporters indicated that they might even take to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet. I don't think the tensions are that high, but we should watch carefully for the potential for post-election violence. In terms of another election, I don't think, I'd be very surprised if President Karzai gets more than 50%, and if all of these complaints are dealt with, and if it looks like the gap between Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah remains large. Currently, it's, I think, 54-28% with more than 90% of the votes in, but not dealing with many of these complaints. I'd be surprised that you'd see some sort of extra constitutional, extra legal mechanism to try to rerun these elections. I mean, that's in the hands of the Afghan institutions and the Afghan people, but that would be an extraordinary instance. And I don't see many people talking about that right now.
How transparent is the process, or will be the process, of going over these 700 serious complaints? And are the Afghan people really watching it, or do you think they've made up their minds?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I speculate that many Afghan people. We should, remember that only about 4 to 5 million Afghans voted in this election out of an eligible 15 million. So there were significant numbers of Afghans disenfranchised. Some of it by choice. I think we heard some apathy, but some of it because of violence and intimidation. There were nearly 400 attacks on election day. So I'm not certain how closely, the vast majority of Afghan people in Afghanistan are actually looking at these complaints at this point. It's the supporters of the various candidates that I would watch carefully and see what sort of statements have been made. And so far, beyond kind of the allegations of fraud, we've not seen any serious indications that they would take it to the streets in terms of violence in result of like we saw, in Iran and widespread protests. I don't think we're at that stage yet, but it could arrive at that point in September or October.
President Karzai has complained that the United States hasn't been supporting him. They've attacked his family, said they were involved in drug dealing. His running mates, who have been accused of being warlords, are brought back in order to make deals with various tribes and get their votes. What about the relations with the United States, and how important is it to the Obama administration that President Karzai win or lose?
Well, look, at this point, I think the Obama administration has been quite neutral in saying we've got to wait for the results, we've got to wait for the Afghan institutions to deal with these complaints. But before the elections actually happened, there were serious strains in the relationship with Karzai. Our ambassador in Kabul, Ambassador Eikenberry, appeared beside Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, two of the main challengers, in a news conference in June. And that led to some vocal protests on the part of Karzai and some of his supporters. The tensions over the fact that Karzai released and pardoned five key drug traffickers and his alliances with Fahim and Dostum, who have ties both to human rights abuses and drug trafficking, raised some serious concerns. So this relationship, I think, has moved already to a different phase. Many people, particularly those in the Karzai camp, feel like they have not been getting the support from the Obama administration, that there's been a bit of a cold shoulder here. And if President Karzai is, in fact, reelected, I think there'll be a lot of work that needs to be done diplomatically to try to restore that relationship between the United States and President Karzai.
Brian Katulis with the Center for American Progress, a member of the Democracy International Election Observation Mission in Afghanistan. Many thanks, as always.
All right. Thank you, Warren.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geist with Cameron Radziner and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.